Happy President's Day, everyone. This is a holiday that most Americans don't really celebrate anymore, except that some things that are usually open on Mondays are closed. But considering how intense people's feelings are when it comes to the current occupant of the White House, it might be worth our time to look at the institution of the presidency a little more closely with the long arc of history for perspective. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking to the author of a new book from the University Press of Kansas. The book is called The Lost Soul of the American Presidency. Steve Knott, good morning.
Hey, good morning. It's great to be with you.
I want to say that the subtitle of your book is a little more optimistic because it includes prospects for renewal.
Yes, it does. And I try to be as optimistic as I possibly can.
Today, so people might assume from the title that this book is about Trump just because of where we are in discourse right now. But it's not. It's about all the presidents, including lesser known figures like John Quincy Adams, who I'm suddenly very interested in.
Yeah, that's a terrific point. I actually thought about writing this book long before President Trump took the oath of office. So the point of this book is not necessarily to bash Donald Trump, although I have a chapter in there that's very critical of him. But I wanted to highlight a sort of different model of the presidency that people like John Quincy Adams personified. Adams had just, a good grasp of the role of the president as a unifying figure, as a head of state, and not somebody who was supposed to stir the partisan pot and fire up the base. So Adams, unfortunately, had the misfortune of running against one of our, I would consider to be, most demagogic presidents, and that was Andrew Jackson, who kind of ran circles around him. But Adams maintained his dignity, fulfilled his constitutional obligations to the office, and I think provides a role model for us today about the proper role of the president in the American system.
When you talk about the soul of the American presidency, what does that mean to you?
Well, it means to me, just to repeat something I said, that the president is our head of state. He's our chief of state. He's the equivalent of, to some extent, a monarch. And he does represent the United States as a nation and not a partisan political leader. So there was an understanding of the presidency pre-20th century that the role of the president was to act as that unifying figure, not constantly speak out and stir the pot. The president was supposed to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That was his primary responsibility, not serve as a divisive partisan leader. And unfortunately, we've moved away from that head of state role, from appreciating the role of the president as someone to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And we've also moved away from the idea that the president should be restrained in terms of what he promises the American people that he can deliver.
I want to just say we're saying he because so far they have all been he's.
That is correct, and thank you for pointing that out. But yes, certainly no insult intended, and I'm sure that barrier is going to fall at some point relatively soon.
So a word that comes up a lot in this book is demagoguery. Can we get a quick definition of that word?
Yeah, I think it's a technique used by political figures to divide, but also to divide for the purpose of advancing their own interests. So it plays on the passions, it plays on the emotions of the public in order to attain political power. And it frequently involves targeting a specific outgroup. That can be a racial minority. It could be a political minority. It could even be an economic minority. But it's using rhetoric to enhance one's own power in a very divisive and emotion-laden way.
So today, I just want to kind of underline this. The founding fathers were trying to avoid mixing up the president in demagoguery. The definition you just gave, that just describes running for president now.
That is correct. And so that is why the founders tried to create a system where you did not run. The idea of running or wanting to acquire that office was seen as beneath the dignity of the office and beneath the dignity of the Constitution itself. So you stood for office, and you might have surrogates out there who publish newspaper editorials and so forth, but you did not engage in what Hamilton called the little arts of popularity.
I love that phrase, the little arts of popularity. I want to say there are so many assumptions we make today about the presidency that were not foregone conclusions as far as the founding fathers' concerns were concerned. And one of the big ones, like you've said, is that a president should not campaign for office. And then once in office, like, the idea was not that they were sort of carrying the mantle of those large groups of people who voted for them. It was actually something else entirely. Can you explain that?
Sure. Yeah, it was that the president was to take his and eventually hers constitutional oath seriously. And
the Constitution was like a buffer in some ways against misguided ideas people might come up with.
That is absolutely correct. And unfortunately, what has happened is we've sort of eroded that sense that the president has a higher obligation to take care the laws be faithfully executed. And instead, he, eventually she, is seen as somebody who we expect to become a partisan leader and become the sort of chief policymaker of the United States. That role, that last role of policymaking, that was supposed to be Congress's role. And we've lost sense of that as well. So the presidency that I'm talking about, the one that I wish we would sort of move at least somewhat in a direction towards, is a much more sober office, a restrained office, one that does not play on people's passions, one that does not seek to divide the American people, but instead seeks to unify the American people and to appeal to the better angels of their natures, as Lincoln once said.
You know, there's another phrase that comes up a lot in this book that might be surprising to people other than the little arts of popularity. This phrase is the tyranny of the majority, which is a phrase that might sound anti-democratic, but it does sound as though protecting not only the rights of minorities, but also just keeping the entire country safe from bad ideas. That was something that the founding fathers really were concerned about. We emphasized that they were afraid of monarchs, but they were also coming out of a revolution. They were also really interested in stability and reason over passion.
Absolutely true. Well put. This notion that the president has this responsibility to abide by the Constitution, and in fact, it's his responsibility, or at least it was foreseen to be his responsibility, to protect those groups within American society who are not part of the majority. The founders had a very healthy appreciation for this concept of the tyranny of the majority. And in fact,
is that John Stuart Mill?
I'm not sure, actually. That
okay.
probably
it's
comes
big
later.
Political philosopher. But
oh,
go
John
on.
John Locke. John Locke.
John Locke.
Yes.
That one. That's the
yes.
one.
Yeah. So Locke was very influential in terms of the thinking of the framers. They were deeply concerned about the rights of, I keep using the term minority groups, and it's not necessarily racial minorities, but just minorities of any kind, against the tyranny of the majority, which you referred to. What happens is that changes over time. The president comes to be seen as the spokesperson for the majority. And that's where the problems begin to kick in. He's not intended to do that role.
So just a couple specific presidents. We're going to have to take a break at some point, but we'll just get started real quick. I want to talk about a few specific presidents, starting with George Washington. He was the first president, so he took big ideas and was kind of like the test case, with a lot of help from Alexander Hamilton. What were some of the big ideological tensions in Washington's time over what a president should be and how a president should behave?
So the ideological tensions, and there were also tensions over just what we might call presidential style. Washington took what people consider to be a somewhat high-toned approach to the presidency. He would travel around in a fancy white coach pulled by, you know, six horses and a military guard. And it was quite a show that he would put on.
Yeah, must be nice.
Jefferson thought that that was a little too over the top, a little too monarchical, a little too British. And Jefferson had a very different conception of the presidency, which is, A, you don't even go on grand tours of the country like Washington did, because it was seen in the eyes of Jefferson, you're making this president, again, a kind of elected monarch. And that's contrary to Jefferson's spirit of 1776. So Jefferson offers an alternative view of a much more toned down, simplified president who does not conduct himself in a sort of semi-monarchical manner.
As I mentioned, I became kind of a fan of John Quincy Adams thanks to your book. He's the sixth president, far from the most famous, but there's this path from George Washington to John Quincy Adams, and something shifts with John Quincy Adams. And I just wonder if you can kind of talk about that.
Oh, sure. So Jefferson sort of opens the door to this idea that the president is, in a sense, uniquely responsible for implementing the will of the majority. And he also seems to suggest that the president's real power rests with that majority, not in the Constitution, but in the majority. And then that door gets completely kicked open by Andrew Jackson, who just flat out says the majority is to govern. And Jackson does not share that fear of majority tyranny that we spoke about earlier. John Quincy Adams is more of a throwback to that Washington and Hamilton conception. He tries to argue that if you root the presidency and you root the federal government in the popular will of the majority, then some folks are going to pay the price. And the people who paid the price at that time were African and Native Americans.
Yeah, I mean, he really kind of had this very, like, an idea that I think is still seen as kind of a radical one, that that small groups of people need to have as much of a voice as large groups of people.
No question. And so what you see, both when John Quincy Adams is president and then he goes back to Massachusetts and runs for the House of Representatives and wins, and actually makes more of a name for himself on these issues in the House than he did in the White House. But Adams understood the dangers of race baiting and of mob violence, and takes a very, very sympathetic stance towards African Americans and Native Americans.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We will continue this conversation in just a minute. We're chatting with Steve Knott about his book, The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, and we'll go from Lincoln to Trump right after this break. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with Steve Knott, author of The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, a new book from the University Press of Kansas. Hi again, Steve.
Hi.
So, Lincoln. Let's talk about Lincoln. We think of him in terms of the dramatic change he ushered into the country, not in terms of how he carried the mantle of the presidency. Help us see him in those terms.
Well, he's, I think, the most interesting president of all, arguably, although I have a real soft spot for George Washington. But Lincoln combines the best of sort of the founders or Hamiltonian presidency that we just talked about with some of the elements of Jefferson and Jackson. In other words, acknowledging that the public and public opinion itself needs to be a part of the process, in a sense. So he combines both Hamilton's vision of the presidency with elements of Jefferson and Jackson's vision and produces, I think, in some ways, the perfect mix, the perfect balance. Now, having said that, it's also important to note Lincoln is frequently criticized for being a dictator by some. Certainly at the time of his presidency in the South, he was viewed that way. And even today, you'll hear a lot of libertarians criticize Lincoln for his alleged abuses of executive power. But this was a man who was confronted with an incredible challenge to the existence of the American regime. And I think, I would argue, and responded in a very moderate way. It's interesting to note that Lincoln never personalized the Civil War. He never criticized Jefferson Davis personally. He never criticized the Confederate Army personally. In other words, he never used language like traitors and things of that sort. So this is a very moderate man who constantly tried to appeal, as he put it, to the better angels of our nature, and I think walked that fine line just perfectly.
Okay, so what about Theodore Roosevelt? He really changed the presidency as well as our understanding of what it means to be presidential. How did he do that?
So he took this idea that Jefferson and Jackson had first broached, that the president really needs to be the spokesman for the majority, and he sort of raises it to a new level using some advances in communication. T.R. is one of our first presidents who understands the power of media, and he, for instance, uses his family as a kind of public relations tool, as cynical as that sounds, to develop a rapport with the American public. And what you're going to see in the 20th century, and it really does start with T.R., is this personalization of the presidency. Presidents want you to think of them as their friend, as somebody you could have a beer with. And That's a real dramatic change from all presidents prior to TR, who kind of kept their distance from the public, again, in the service of those principles that I mentioned earlier, that the president needs to be faithful to the law, not to the majority of the public.
John F. Kennedy.
So I'm talking to you from Massachusetts, and I grew up in a New Frontier, John F. Kennedy-loving family. I have some pretty tough things to say about President Kennedy in this book.
Okay, so we're ready.
So I'm not sure I'll be welcomed back at any family reunions. But, you know, Kennedy uses television. He continues the process begun by T.R. and Woodrow Wilson and FDR of taking advantage of technological advances to form this personal bond with the public. And he also is very adept at using his family, his young, beautiful, attractive family, to forge that bond.
And that, this idea that the personality is a part of the presidency.
That's correct. Absolutely correct. And it's all part of this desire to put the presidency front and center, to make the president the center of action. And in fact, Kennedy used to say that a president should be as big a man as he wants to be. This kind of an unlimited sense of what the presidency should attempt to accomplish. And I argue in the book that that sets us on a path to constantly unfulfilled expectations. We expect our presidents to deliver the world to us, and they can't. That's an impossible thing to do. Kennedy's one of many presidents who puts us on this unsustainable path.
Okay. I want to talk also about Bill Clinton, which... you know, you make a pretty compelling argument that the line from Bill Clinton to Donald Trump is a short line, a rather short line. And I think that in the partisan kind of discourse we exist in, that might be a tough pill for some people to swallow. And that kind of doesn't matter which of those figures they might like more than the other.
It is a tough pill for a lot of folks to swallow, and I'm hoping a lot of my friends don't read this book because they won't be friends anymore. But look, you have to put aside that personal devotion that you feel, a person feels towards a particular president. The presidency was not intended to develop a cult following. And I do think President Clinton did take some steps that the Trump folks learned from, which was, you know, attack, attack, attack. Even if it means attacking the Justice Department or a particular special prosecutor, in this case, Kenneth Starr. I argue in the book that President Clinton crossed the line when he lied in front of a grand jury and in front of a federal judge. That is pretty serious. He never should have put himself in that position. But to also go on and attack the FBI, the Justice Department, the special prosecutor, just set a bad trend. Did he deserve to be impeached? Maybe not. But that attack tactics that they used were learned quite well by Trump and his people.
You also write about the pardons at the very end of his presidency.
Yes, yes. So even there, you see a kind of disregard. The whole justice.
Can you explain what happened with those pardons for people who, like, I was pretty young at the end of the Clinton presidency, and I kind of vaguely remembered those things, but reading about it now, like, really refreshed my memory. Can you share the details?
Sure. There were hundreds of pardons issued by President Clinton in the last 72 hours or so of his presidency, almost all of which circumvented the normal Justice Department procedure for pardon applications. And some of the pardons were questionable. I think his own half-brother was one of them. One of Hillary Clinton's relatives was one of them. A major contributor to the Clinton Presidential Library was one of them, happened to be the wife of a guy who was on the lam from the FBI. Just very, very questionable actions that really, I think, constituted a type of abuse of power. And again, that pardon power
relating
is extraordinary.
Relating to financial profit.
Yeah, I mean, again, that major contributor to the Clinton Library and to sort of post-presidential Clinton activities from, I'm talking about a guy named Mark Rich and his wife. This was very questionable stuff, and I think it helped to besmirch the presidency and Bill Clinton's reputation.
Kudos on using besmirch in 2020. Talk to me about Trump and also just where we are as we embark on another election season, because, you know, you must hear today's discourse in a different way, given your sense of the history of the office we are electing someone to.
I do hear it in a different way, and for the most part, it appalls me. I try to stay off social media as much as I can. Look, Donald Trump's presidency is the logical end result of this Jeffersonian, Jacksonian, Teddy Roosevelt presidency. I mean, look at how he was selected. The Republican Party, the leadership, really didn't want him, but they've eroded the power of the leadership so much that the selection of a presidential candidate is completely up to the public, completely up to a majority of the public who decides to participate. That's not the way it was supposed to work. And Trump's, what I would consider to be demagogic appeals to popular passions, are precisely what Hamilton and Washington warned about when they spoke about the little arts of popularity and the dangers that that presents, particularly to minority groups.
So prospects for renewal are in the subtitle of your book. I have to hear what these are, because this, you're leaving us on a very dismal note.
Yeah, sorry to do that. Yeah.
Prospects for renewal, though.
Sure.
It says so on the cover.
It does say so, doesn't it? Yes. I think we need a restoration of party power, party leadership. You had a situation in 2016 where Trump was not the choice of party leaders, nor was Bernie Sanders. Both of those guys almost won. Trump did, of course. I don't think either one of them would have gotten close to the presidency if the party leadership had a role to play. So that would be step one for me. But the most important thing of all is civic education, convincing the American people there is an alternative way here. We don't need to keep going down this path.
I just have to say that so many people are really skeptical of party leadership.
Sure.
Opposed to the will of the people.
No question. And we've all been taught to believe that the more we're involved and the more transparent and the more democratized the process is, the better. I'm just trying to make the case. You've got to always be concerned about the potential for the tyranny of the majority. Some filtering needs to be in there. God willing, we'll get there at some point.
Okay. You heard it here first. The tyranny of the majority is to be feared. We'll be right back in just a minute with a podcast. We'll be listening to the People's History of Kansas City with the scoop on Lincoln Prep, the school's historically black roots and what they mean today. Central Standard brings you that podcast after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now let's hear what graduates of Lincoln High or Lincoln Prep in Kansas City have to say about their school's storied past and why it matters. It's the latest from the People's History of Kansas City, a podcast hosted by Suzanne Hogan.
What were you like in high school?
I feel like I was kind of shy.
I think I was a nerd, but at the same time, I was like decent at sports.
Bad.
How so?
Mischievous, always looking to get into things.
High school can be a strange and formative time. Learning new things about the world, yourself, making new friends, exploring your identity, finding out where you fit in and what you like, what kind of person you want to grow up and become. You just heard the voices of three people who attended Lincoln High School in Kansas City. It's now known as Lincoln College Preparatory Academy. Lincoln is a prestigious, historically black school that was founded over 150 years ago. All three of these Lincoln alumni admit that when they were in high school, the history and legacy of their school wasn't necessarily top of mind. But there was a feeling about Lincoln, an identity, that was just kind of understood.
This has always been the school where all the smart black kids come from. Or this has been the school, you know, where you can name check, you know, the Ollie Gates of the world or Lucille Bluford or Frank White, these famous historic black Kansas Cityans.
Musicians Charlie Parker and Walter Page, civil rights leaders Leon Jordan and Dr. Julia Hill, and singer Julia Lee.
Cause I've been to Kansas City, that's the blues I gotta lose.
It's interesting, we had an African-American history class at Lincoln, but it wasn't necessarily a class that focused on Lincoln's history.
Aaron Randall graduated from Lincoln in 2007. A self-described nerdy kid who could also hang with the jocks. Now a reporter, Aaron says he started hearing some interesting things from friends and people in the community about certain changes that were happening at his former high school.
Some said that it was a totally white school. And then some people said that it seemed a little different. And then some said it didn't seem that different, but at the same time, they could tell that it wasn't the school that they remembered. And so I just was really curious.
Aaron wanted to find out the truth. How much had his high school really changed?
And once I saw actual numbers and actual data that showed that Lincoln was rapidly changing in a drastic way, you know, the black population was declining to a rate in a rate that they would be the minority by 2023. I just felt that that was a compelling story, particularly with Lincoln Prep's history as an historically black high school and its connection to the black community.
The story ran on the front page of the Kansas City Star last spring. It was the last big piece Aaron Randall wrote for the Star before leaving for the New York Times. He says it felt like going full circle, having this final story at the paper be about his high school, diving into complex issues all about race, culture, and identity in his home city.
It's about, you know, a community that feels that it already doesn't have much. And so it's like they feel like they're losing a big weapon in their arsenal, so to speak, right? Like they're losing a major gem.
This is A People's History of Kansas City, a podcast from KCUR 89.3. I'm Suzanne Hogan.
You can't stop time.
You know, you're like, man, why did I know that before? This is my history.
There's value in having that story that you pass on that, oh, I was part of this larger thing.
On this episode, the history of Lincoln College Preparatory Academy. We're going to explore how this institution, this major gem, shaped Kansas City. How has it changed over the years? Why has it changed? And what's being done to make sure that the school's legacy is being preserved and passed on to future generations? We'll hear more from Aaron Randall and his reporting a little bit later, but first, let's just dive into it. Even some alumni I talked to admitted that they really didn't fully learn about Lincoln's history until they got older and researched it for themselves. And just to put it out there, I didn't go to Lincoln. I had some friends who went there, but I also didn't know anything about its backstory until I got into radio and started researching black history in Kansas City.
Kansas City, like most cities, education was segregated from the very beginning.
Mike Sweeney is with the State Historical Society of Missouri. He previously worked for the Black Archives. He serves as the official historian for Lincoln's Alumni Association. He's a white guy who's passionate about Lincoln's story and the impact it's had on developing our city.
It's a history of business leaders and educators and religious leaders and, you know, community, the story of community.
So it all started at a church at what's now 10th and McGee at the end of the Civil War.
Previous to this, during the Civil War, of course, it was against the law to educate blacks.
Even so, during that time, there are numerous accounts of people defying that law, mainly church groups who were pushing for African-American education and abolition. For example, this black pastor in St. Louis, John Barry Meacham, helped found one of the oldest black churches in Missouri. And he made a floating freedom school. Since educating black people was illegal, he moved his classroom to a steamboat on the Mississippi River, which was outside of the reach of Missouri law. So the Civil War ended in 1865, and it's then that Missouri adopts a new constitution. It, among many other things, banned slavery and created free public schools for all young people. But the schools were to be segregated. So back to Lincoln. Around the time when the Civil War ends, in Kansas City, a black pastor named Reverend Copeland and his wife started offering educational opportunities at their church.
It was really just to educate the black populace, not just children, adults, anybody, but in basic skills necessary for just being citizens.
In 1867, the Kansas City School District comes into existence. Those students and educators officially became Lincoln Elementary and part of the district. Missouri law basically said that if you had enough of a black population, you had to provide education. But if you didn't, then you didn't. So a lot of black students from lesser populated areas commuted to or even moved so they could attend Lincoln. They came from places like Westport, St. Joseph, Independence, and lots of other smaller towns. Lincoln eventually moved to 11th and Campbell and expanded into a high school in 1890.
See if I can actually, I can maybe even find you this map really quickly.
Mike Sweeney shows me a map and some old pictures of that area, which at the end of the 1800s used to be a focal point of the black community. Today, those buildings are gone. It's right where Highway 70 meets 71. As we enter the 20th century, Kansas City's black population is booming, along with the overall population. And the schools were trying to accommodate all the new students coming in. The district built a new school, but even then, it very quickly became clear that Lincoln needed an even bigger facility. Keep in mind, up until 1954, Lincoln High School was the only place in Jackson, Platte, and Clay counties where an African-American student could receive secondary education, which is where one of historian Mike Sweeney's heroes comes along, Principal H.O. Cook.
Particularly those early principals really captured this whole idea that in Kansas City, we had nationally known African-American figures living here, nationally engaged folks.
Cook grew up in a well-to-do family on the East Coast and moved to Kansas City in the early 1900s. He served as Lincoln High School's principal from 1921 to 1943. It was the Great Depression, but Principal Cook rallied the black community and raised funds. And in 1936, the new Lincoln High School at 20th and Woodland opened up its doors. It became known as the Castle on the Hill. The four-story brick building had an eye-catching lookout tower. The new facility had a swimming pool, updated science labs, two gyms, and a two-story auditorium. On top of running this brand new school, Principal Cook was a central figure in the black community.
I got interested in him when I was working at the Black Archives because I kept seeing his name pop up everywhere.
At the height of Jim Crow laws and in the midst of racial discrimination in the city, Cook tackled community health, black economic independence, and he was part of the early years of Kansas City's NAACP chapter.
It's part of this larger thing about racial uplift.
The school attracted other nationally renowned black educators who were also involved in the community, teachers of major university caliber, people like Harlem Renaissance artist Aaron Douglas, jazz band leader Nathaniel Clark Smith. The first high school building, which had been near 18th and Vine, became R.T. Cole's vocational school. There, people could learn different skills that could help them get better jobs. And the new school, the Castle on the Hill, became a focal point of African-American higher education in the city. It offered night school for adults. It was always hosting different community events and meetings. Lincoln Junior College was on the top floor. Ronald Walton went to R.T. Cole's vocational school and then graduated from Lincoln High School in 1954.
We felt we had everything in our community that we needed.
That year that Ron graduated, 1954, was the year of Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, the Supreme Court case that was supposed to end segregated public schools. But Ron says, as a young man, the significance of that Supreme Court case didn't register with him at first.
Because the environment that we had grown up in and what I had been accustomed to, I think my feeling was, well, big deal. We don't need those schools. We've got our schools.
The way Ron remembers it, the stretch from Independence to 27th Street, Truce to as far east as Mercington, was a segregated, tight-knit black community where folks took care of each other. Ron says lots of families would let Lincoln students commuting from far away stay with them throughout the week. Ron understands that things have changed. It's not that he wants to go backwards. It's just that he's proud of how the black community fought discrimination and all the things they built and accomplished in those days.
You can't stop time. If you could stop time and put that particular aspect of life as I knew it, that would be the perfect scenario. You would have Lincoln, Coles, the black community, the closeness, all of those things that living in that situation brought about, whether you liked it or not.
Ron says it was that closeness that helped him out in his formative years.
My youth was kind of rough. I was a scoundrel, mischievous, bad. I was always being counseled and told you from a good family, why is it that you don't do what we know you can do? That all resonates with me today, and I pass that on to my children.
His senior year, he almost dropped out, but he says it was that community and the faculty at Lincoln that helped him get his act together so he could graduate. Ron opens up his senior yearbook as I try to guess which picture is his.
Okay, I'll get the page for you and you see if you can locate me.
Is that you? Yeah, I could see it. Of course.
That diploma and the education Ron got from Lincoln 66 years ago is something he says he will forever be proud of. He's now the president of the Lincoln R.T. Coles National Alumni Association. It's a group that provides scholarships for Lincoln students. They also organized to get a plaque put up at the old R.T. Coles site near 18th and Vine, where the vocational school had been knocked down. Ron says now that he's in his 80s, it feels really important to him to make sure the history of these places is not forgotten.
This is my main purpose.
That Supreme Court decision to integrate schools in 1954 started a very, very slow movement that could culminate in 2023, the year Lincoln is projected to no longer be a majority black school. It's a forecast that really bothers Ron.
That's the conflict. I understand that things change, and to keep Lincoln as it was in the 50s when I went there would be ridiculous. But I'm not completely satisfied with the changes and what I see from my point of view that it's producing.
After Brown versus Board, the Kansas City District was ordered to integrate, quote, as quickly as possible. But neighborhoods stayed segregated because of white flight and discriminatory housing practices like redlining. And lax transfer policies in the district tended to favor white students.
The integration, I think it was intended to do well, but the way it turned out, I would like to have a do-over.
In the late 1970s, over 20 years after Brown versus Board, the Kansas City Public School District was still mostly racially segregated. It took nearly a quarter of a century after the case for Lincoln to officially open up for integration. Because Kansas City schools were still so segregated, a new mandated plan was put in place intended to, quote, wipe out segregation. The new plan boosted teachers' salaries and created state-of-the-art magnet schools. The idea was that it would draw more white families into the mostly black district. Lincoln became one of those magnet schools, and academic requirements changed for incoming students, meaning you had to take an exam and have a minimum GPA to attend. Nicole Puryear was a senior at Lincoln the year they started enforcing the minimum GPA requirements.
It was really sad because I know at some point we realized that some of our classmates were not coming back.
Nicole says more than 50 of her classmates had to transfer to their neighborhood schools. More than any other high school in the district, Lincoln saw an increase in diversity as a result of the magnet school plan. When Nicole graduated in 1986, the school was still mostly black. But by the time her own kids went to Lincoln in the early 2000s, the student body and the teaching staff had become more white.
Some of the culture was a little bit different.
Nicole, now an educator herself, remembers having a lot of the same black teachers all throughout her high school days. She thinks staff turnover was part of why Lincoln just felt different when her kids went there.
You don't realize how easy it is for things to kind of disappear, and it doesn't really take that long for, you know, knowledge to kind of fade away.
A fellow alumni told Nicole a story that highlighted that very point. A few years ago, a large alumni group went to the high school to see a student performance. And afterwards, one of the students, who is black, went up to the alumni group and asked a startling question.
Why is everybody black? And he's like, and he had to explain to her, you know, the history of Lincoln. And she was like, oh, I didn't know. I can't believe I didn't know that. And I think she was a little hurt.
Nicole is now actively involved with the Alumni Association, with Ron. She admits even she could have done a better job of educating her own kids about the history of Lincoln. But now she's part of the next generation of alumni who are trying to make sure every Lincoln student knows its backstory.
Even as an adult, when you learn these obscure or different things about black history that, you know, you're like, man, why did I not know that before? This is my history.
66 years after Brown v. Board, our nation's public schools still struggle with economic and racial segregation. In Kansas City, where 60% of the city identifies as white, white enrollment in the district is still only 10%. But when you look at Lincoln, it kind of shines as this beacon of diversity, with 40% of the student body identifying as black, about 20% as white, and 30% as Latino. But with black enrollment dropping at the school, what does this historic incubator of black excellence risk to lose as it becomes more diverse? Which brings us back to where we started. Lincoln alum and newspaper reporter Aaron Randall, in his article that came out last May. The headline was, "Lincoln Prep Soon May No Longer Be Majority Black." Is that a sign of loss or progress?
Okay, well, why is this thing happening?
Randall's report said that for the past 5 years, Lincoln's black enrollment has been dropping 3 percentage points on average.
Some of the misinformation out there was the district was kind of targeting white students, or, you know, there were concentrated efforts to keep black students out. And in my reporting, at least, I did not find that.
My conversations with the district also confirmed that. There are no concerted efforts to recruit only white students or to keep black students out. The district and administrators at Lincoln say they work hard to recruit students from throughout the city. They say that what's happening at Lincoln reflects some of the bigger demographic shifts that are just happening throughout the city.
I found that a big piece of the puzzle was the fact that blacks are suburbanizing in Kansas City. They're moving to the suburbs at a constantly rising rate. And that's been happening since I was in, you know, high school. I've seen, you know, lots of even my family members who have lived in the city their whole lives. They live in the Lee Summits and the Blue Springs and all these different suburbs.
Black enrollment in suburban districts like Blue Springs and Lee Summit has increased. According to the Mid-America Regional Council, Kansas City's urban core is seeing a drop in the black population, while historically black neighborhoods are seeing more Latino and affluent white families move in.
I mean, look right down the street from Lincoln Prep in the historic Beacon Hill community. You know, that community that's always been historically black is now quite diverse.
At Lincoln, in the past 10 years, the white population has been around 15%. The most drastic change has been in the Latino population, which has doubled. If it continues at its current rate, Lincoln's Latino population will surpass the black population by 2023. Lincoln is becoming more brown.
I don't think necessarily that the answer here is to stop the diversification of Lincoln Prep, right? Like, it's not about keeping white or Hispanic kids out or somehow unfairly boosting the amount of black kids. I think what this at its core is about, this story and this narrative, is the black community and their fear of losing a cultural marker, their cultural identity.
Aaron says it also gets at our city's complicated relationship with race.
It has such a fraught racial tension.
And it's a tension that goes beyond race and culture.
And really of other things, you know, of power dynamics and of wealth, of geography. Like, there are many different intersections of that city that I think people have never really fully engaged and try to understand.
After Lincoln, Aaron ended up going to Howard University, a historically black college. There, he says, they made sure every student who attends knows the history and background of the school. He says he'd like to see Lincoln take a similar approach.
I think that it will be a disservice to not only the school, but the city and the students if they don't do that.
Our historian earlier touched on this, too. Lincoln, as in the building, is a protected historic site, but it's also a functioning high school. In a city where few African-American historic sites remain beyond those centered around jazz and baseball, and as the city and historically black neighborhoods are changing, Aaron Randall, Mike Sweeney, Ronald Walton, and Nicole Perrier want to know what is going to be done to make sure students know Lincoln's history, no matter what the racial demographic of the student body or faculty is.
We are taking those steps to make sure that kids understand how special this place is.
Christian Foster has been the principal here for 3 years. She was previously at Sumner High School in Kansas City, Kansas, another historically black school that shares a lot of history with Lincoln, but we'll have to save that story for another episode. Christian, who is white, is also a mother to a Lincoln alumni. She, of course, read Aaron's article and says maintaining Lincoln's academic excellence and rigor while preserving the history of the school is front of mind. On top of having new students watch a student-made video that tells Lincoln's story, she's been working with the Alumni Association to revamp the alumni room.
My involvement has just been one of support and, you know, advocating in any way that I can to make sure that that space is preserved in a piece of history that people can view.
And another student-led project is underway.
These are the theater doors right here.
And behind you actually was an old ticket booth.
Over the years, the front entryway to the auditorium had become a storage area for different school supplies. But these Lincoln seniors had an idea. Their plan was to completely clean out the entryway and spruce it up. They want it to be a welcome gathering place, like it used to be. They also plan to paint a mural that will include different aspects of Lincoln's history. It's a history some of them admit they just learned about last year.
I was really shocked when I found out because I'm like, that's something that should be known. That's something that our student body should know and like should be proud of.
Michelle Saul is one of the seniors working on the front hallway project. She wants to be a lawyer. Let's meet some of the other students from the class of 2020.
My name's Solandra Torres. I do know I want to go into physical therapy or double major in nursing and Spanish so I could become a translator in the hospitals.
My name's Madeline Solder. I do plan on studying abroad to practice my French or Spanish and just see where that takes me.
My name's Asada Jahad. I plan to major in mass communications while I start my pre-med track. And then after, I plan to go to med school and become a podiatrist and go back to Africa, where my family is from, and open a nonprofit for podiatry because feet are important in Africa. A lot of people carry their lives on bare feet, which can obviously become a problem.
How long have you known that that's your plan?
2 months ago.
And then there's Anthony Moses, who has accepted a full ride to MU and wants to major in biology.
Right now, it's really to just focus on finishing this year and then just striving on like what is in the present, not so much as what's in the future.
I'm like excited about the future, knowing that you guys are going to be in charge. And what about senioritis?
Oh, senioritis, I have that.
It's freshman year.
It's a real thing. Yes. But we're going to fight through it, right? Yeah, of course, yeah. We got to finish strong. Yeah.
This group of seniors is ambitious. They still have a lot to do before they graduate in May. They also read Aaron Randall's article last year and say it made the hallway project feel more important and urgent. Michelle Saul says she wants to leave a legacy and honor the history of this place because it's been such an important part of her story.
I was used to like moving schools like almost like every 2 years. I was in a new school, new country, you know, things like that. And then I never felt like I truly like belonged. I had like a real space that I could say like, oh, this is like my space, you know. And like I felt that at Lincoln because like I was able to find just like a diverse group of friends. And then we just all clicked since I came here. And then we just became a family, you know. And like 10 years from now, where you go, I'm like, yeah, I'm from Lincoln, blah, 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 in Kansas City, you know, it's something proud.
It is something to be proud of. The school has been a historic incubator of Black excellence, and the effects of that excellence can be seen in the ripple down and all the amazing accomplishments its alumni have gone on to achieve. Even though the city and the school's demographics are changing, Lincoln continues to be a place that's producing brilliant young minds. But is every student in the city, regardless of their race, background, or ability to qualify, receiving quality education without discrimination? Are communities who are more disenfranchised getting the same amount of academic and community support that they need in order to succeed? What was lost when Black students were no longer taught primarily by Black teachers? These are the types of questions that plague educators and policymakers, and really all of us who are concerned about equality and encouraging the next generation of leaders. We need to make sure that these stories, like the story of Lincoln, become part of our curriculum, part of how we talk about the history of our city and how we got to where we are today. We need to know and appreciate how hard people fought to make this beacon of Kansas City Black history something we are all proud to be a part of today.
That was Suzanne Hogan with The People's History of Kansas City, a production of KCUR and the Mid-Continent Public Library. We'll be rolling out the episodes every Monday through the end of the first season, but you can also subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Suzanne works with KCUR's Sylvia Maria Gross, Mike Russo, and others to bring us these stories. If you missed our conversation about the presidency with the author of a new book from the University Press of Kansas, check it out. We'll have it ready for you online by the end of the day, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, food insecurity in Missouri, and Wednesday, we'll have our Screen Time episode on The Good Place. So if you haven't gotten to the series finale, the time to binge is now. I repeat, the time to binge is now. If you are a voter under 25, we also want to hear from you about what you're thinking going into the 2020 elections, both primaries and general election. What's on your mind? That kind of thing. You can email us all about it, centralstandard@kcur.org, and who knows, maybe you'll end up on this show. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next, so don't go away.